Come to the 64th annual OA birthday party. Together, we get better. In person, January 12th through 14th at the LAX Hilton in Los Angeles, California. Meet fellows from across the globe for a weekend-long extravaganza of workshops, panels, special interest speakers, entertainment, fellowship, laughs, and recovery. Highlights include body image workshop, weekend-long big book study, sober eating workshop, keynote speakers with unique stories, dance party and comedy show, yoga and meditation, meetings and meetups for LGBTQIA, BIPOC, Spanish language, young people, and AAPI members, plus a boutique where you can shop till you drop. Registration is now open at oabirthday.com. Staying the night? Book your room now at a discounted rate through the oabirthday.com website and act fast because rooms sell out quickly. There is a solution. You'll hear from speakers who have various versions of this disease who live happy, joyous, and free. Because together, we get better.
Welcome to the OA Light a Candle Meeting Podcast. Visit our website at oalaig.org, where you will find several speaker feeds with over 800 speaker files, forms for ordering CDs for these speakers, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. The opinions expressed in the Light a Candle Podcast are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Don P.
Hi, I'm Don, compulsive overeater, and I'm passing around my fat pictures to prove it. They have not been around since pre-COVID. They're a little funky, but you'll get the idea. So I don't remember a time in my life that I wasn't a compulsive overeater. I don't remember a time that I didn't have a different relationship with food than all my friends. I remember being so large as a child, much bigger proportionately than I ever was as an adult, that people on the street would like turn and look at me. I remember that I was just unable to stop eating. I'd see my friends do weird things like say, "I'm full," and stop eating with food on their plate, or it's too rich, or it's too something or other. And, you know, if I was eating, there would be no food on my plate or your plate or anything within arm's reach. And you know, people would, with very well-meaning, I still remember this coach in elementary school saying, "Kid, you got to do push-aways." I said, "What are those?" He said, "Push away from the table." And the interesting thing was, it's not like I didn't know what to do. It was just that I couldn't do it. I mean, I can tell everybody here how to lose weight in two words: eat less. Unfortunately, knowing that never did me any good. It was not a matter of learning nutrition. It wasn't a matter of, you know, understanding it intellectually or logically. It was only a matter of not being able to do it. And I would spend periods of time trying to diet. It would be white knuckle hanging on, clawing to it. And it felt like, to me, like a spring winding up inside me. It felt like I was trying to graft something so alien to the core of who I was into my behavior that this tension just built up and built up, and it got tighter and tighter, and then it would explode. And I would go out and make up for lost time and go almost, "Ah," when I started overeating again. And but then I would end up gaining more weight than I lost, and then I would sit there like those little cartoon characters that get bopped with birds tweeting around their heads going, "What happened? Again? What happened?" So I could never lose weight. I mean, yes, for short periods of time. I used to have this dream as a kid that there was this giant amount of food and every bite that I took, I'd lose a pound. It was this total fantasy. That was what I wanted. When I got to college, a rather well-meaning doctor, a friend of the family, gave me a prescription for what basically is speed, and it definitely killed my appetite in the sense I was flying around the room, but I didn't have an appetite. I was eating one meal a day, and yet, despite the fact that I had no appetite, I was continually thinking about food. I was going, "Well, I'm only going to eat one thing, but what about this? Maybe a bite of that. I should this, I should that." I was continually thinking about it, even though I wasn't eating. And sure, I lost weight as long as I kept on the drugs, but as soon as I stopped the drugs, all the weight came back. Same problem again. And this happened. Later in graduate school, I got into a mode of, I'm going to do it right this time. I'm going to eat everything moderately so I don't feel like I'm restricted, and I'll do some exercise and all this. And same experience. Weight went down. Weight came back up. Later in life, I tried the same thing again with even more intense exercise. And, it lasted 4 years. That was the most I'd ever done it in my life. See, I kept thinking to myself, there's got to be a gimmick. There's got to be a trick that I haven't figured out yet. There's got to be a way to do this that I just don't understand. And in other areas of my life, when I've wanted something that I've really cared about, I've pretty much been able to accomplish it. And yet, when it came to the food, it would kick my ass every single time. I couldn't do it. I could do it in other things. I could do it in relationships. I could do it in business. I could do it in school. I could do it in hobbies, where I was always trying to, get some license or do something, that way. But I couldn't do it with the food. And I kept thinking, I don't get it. Why can't I do this? I can do these other things, but I can't do it with the food. It doesn't work. And every time it beats me up, and I kept thinking it's going to be different. So after this 4 years of being healthy and being at a good weight and exercising and feeling great, I was at an event with a friend of mine who was a very heavy guy. And he goes, man, as skinny as you are, you should be having two desserts. And I thought, yeah. And literally from that point, the weight started coming back on. The obsession came back. And I was, once again, I got knocked on my ass. So I heard about Overeaters Anonymous about 10 years before I ever came in the doors. The reason I didn't come in the door was my ego wouldn't fit through it. I just kept thinking, I've got to be able to figure this out myself, because after all, I can do it in these other areas, so I should be able to do it here, right? I just don't know what it is yet. I don't know what the hack is, as they'd say in common day terms, although not back then. I just kept avoiding coming to the room, thinking, I can't sit around with a bunch of strangers and talk about this stuff, and I can't, be embarrassed to be there, and all the ego things that kept me away. But one day, and I, again, vivid memory, laying in bed, feeling this gigantic stomach and going, I give up. I can't do this myself. And I had been going to a nutritionist on and off, and I found out that after I went to the nutritionist for 2 or 3 days, my eating got pretty good, and then, of course, it went back to the norm. And I thought, well, if these meetings do nothing more than get me 2 or 3 days at a time, and I go to a couple of meetings a week, maybe that will do it. So I came in very skeptical, but at least finally admitting it. This was pre-internet. I got abstinent in 1998. So this was pre-internet. I called up the OA office, listened to a long recording about where the meetings are. I went to their log cabin on Robertson, which was a rainy day. It was dark. In fact, that place is kind of dark and depressing even on the best of days. But it was particularly dark and depressing this day. I thought that some of the people there might be brain damaged. I was so completely looking for every reason that I didn't fit in. And I was getting ready to leave, and this tiny little lady named Doris, who was in her 90s at the time, gets between me and the door, and she sticks her finger in my face and says, "Don't leave before the miracle happens." And I thought, what the hell is she talking about? That made no sense to me, but it was kind of intriguing. And I said, well, I don't know what to do. She said, don't have second helpings and come to another meeting. I said, okay. I didn't have second helpings the rest of the day. And the next day I went to Serenity Sunday. And it was completely different. It was bright. It was sunny. There were people laughing. And I looked around and I saw people like Natalie, who'd lost 350 pounds and had it off over 20 years at the time. And to me, it was a kind of a light bulb moment, like when I was learning to ride a bicycle. You get on a bicycle and it falls over because it's two wheels and they don't stand up by themselves. But you look around the neighborhood and there's other kids riding bike whizzing past you. And you go, I guess it can be done. But I was really skeptical. There was a deep secret part of me that thought, you're never going to be able to do this. You're completely doomed. You're going to be living a life of overeating and being overweight your whole life. And, maybe these other people can do it, but you can't. And I genuinely believed if somebody else can do something, I should at least be able to get close or try or give it or see if I could get something out of it. So at that second meeting, my sponsor, Michael, came up to me and said, if you'd like to call me, here's my number. I chose him very scientifically. He was the only one who came up to me. And I started calling him. I've been with him since the beginning, still call him. And I just started, talking about it and starting to get into it and starting to become accountable for what I was doing and who I was and what it was about. And I remember, to be honest, in the beginning, it was kind of a diet club. And you probably gathered from my earlier talk that my personality is very goal-oriented. So I always wanted to go, I'm here, goal's there, what are the steps between, let's do it, let's get it, let's move along. My initial attitude was, how much of this can I get? How quickly can I get it? How little can I give in return? And how soon can I get out of here? Because I really just wanted to sort of absorb the essence and then move along. Turns out, for reasons I'll talk about, that isn't the way it works. And if you'd told me that at the time, it might have discouraged me, but it was what I needed to feel and believe, and that's my path. So when I went up to, and in the beginning it felt a lot like a diet club. I wanted the chips, I wanted the accolades, I wanted the this, that, and the other. So, but that's what kept me coming back, so it worked for me. And I went up to get a 90-day chip, and as I was walking up there, I realized that there was something missing. And to me, I recognized something intruding more than I recognized something missing, because you don't necessarily notice it's gone until you happen to look for it. But it just hit me that I had been losing weight for 90 days, and I didn't have the spring winding up inside me. I didn't feel the tension. I didn't feel like I'd been in prison. I didn't feel like it, and I thought, I don't understand this, but it's qualitatively different from anything I ever experienced in my life. Because any time I dieted, it was just forcibly, horrible. It was just, restricting and craving whatever it was that the diet's not supposed to have, and just feeling uncomfortable and ill at ease. And I didn't feel it. And so I thought, there's something really different here. And I still didn't understand what it was. I 90 days was not very long for me. And I went to Michael, who is in AA, goes to the Pacific Group, this gigantic meeting. And I'm not an alcoholic, but I went with him just because he asked me to, and it was fascinating. But this old-timer was sitting behind me, and he goes, kid, this is $1 million program. You get it a nickel at a time. And it sort of struck me as the farther I get along in the program, the more I get from it, because it builds on itself. And I'm not the same person that I was when I walked in. I'm not the same person that I was 10 years ago. And so I see it differently. I get something different out of it. It gets deeper. It gets more intimate, like any deep relationship. I understand it better. I feel more open to it. I get more from it the more I put into it and the more time that I spend on it. So And I lost the weight right away. I was fortunate. I got abstinent literally the first day, and then I lost the weight right away. And I was feeling so proud of myself and so good until about a year in, when suddenly my pants got tight and I started gaining weight. And my immediate reaction was, don't tell anybody. You're the poster boy for OA. You've got to be the shining example. And fortunately, I realized after about 30 seconds that was the exact opposite of what I needed to do. I needed to be really open about what was going on. Because the things that I keep in the dark, the things that I keep inside me that are covered up, get larger and scarier when they're in the dark. If I pull them out in the light, they're kind of small and shriveled. But when they're sitting back there hidden, and particularly as they gather more of them, it's like sweeping the dust under the rug. It eventually gets a big lump in it. And so I'm so much better off talking about it. And sure enough, by talking about it, I was able to get past it and dissipate it. The expression about being as sick as our secrets it means something to me, even though I don't always like it. But it's not always about what I like. It's about doing something that's good for me. I don't always like brushing my teeth, but I like having teeth. So sometimes I do things that don't make necessarily something I want, but I understand is good for me in the long term. So as I got farther into it and I worked the steps, I really felt the ninth step promises coming true. I really felt a letting go of a lot of fears, a letting go of a lot of things in my life, and it was a very sort of calming, relaxing feeling, which I totally did not expect. There's an expression I heard in the beginning, which I actually found offensive, which was, I came for the vanity and stayed for the sanity. Because number one, it sounds like people are vain, and number two, it sounds like you're crazy. Of course, I even remember saying to my sponsor once about, you know, we admitted our life was unmanageable. I said, I don't know that my life's so unmanageable. He said, really, how's the food part of it? Well, okay. He pretty well had me on that, and I was insane when it came to food. I did things that don't make any logical sense because I felt like I had to do it. So the more I began to get into the program, the way it sort of came into focus for me, and this did not happen right away. It took a fair amount of time, but it was in the doctor's opinion. And the doctor's opinion talks about two things. It said that the disease, he's talking about alcoholism, but it applies equally to me to compulsive overeating. The disease has two parts to it. One is that it's an allergy of the body, which doesn't mean rashes and so forth. It means an abnormal reaction to something. For me, when I start eating compulsively, I cannot stop. I don't see you. I don't hear you. You may as well not be there. In fact, if you're there, I'm actually going to be angry, particularly if you're between me and the food. I disappear. I'm gone. I am not sociable. I am just buried. And I use it to cut off all my emotions. And once I start, I can't stop. Eventually, I guess, I get so, you know, disgusted. But I can remember being completely stuffed and painful and still wanting more. Once that physical craving starts, I can't stop it. The second part, I mean, again, now if you have an allergy and you're allergic to peanuts and you don't eat peanuts, it's not a problem, right? As much as you may like them, you're not going to do it if it's going to send you to the hospital. So unfortunately with our disease, according to the doctor's opinion, it's coupled with an obsession of the mind that tells us we need to do it again and that it's going to be different this time. And I can cheat a little this time because it's going to be different. You know, you've been good, you've been filled in the blank, so you deserve it. Take a little X, Y, and Z. And so there's no way, at least as of today that I know of, that does away with the the allergy once it kicks in your body. But the big book in the program is designed to deal with the obsession of the mind. So in other words, if we don't start eating compulsively, or if I don't start eating compulsively, it's not a problem. When I do start eating compulsively, it is a problem. And I don't mean to come up and sound like I never overeat or I never, you know, get sloppy with things, because I do. There's an analogy of an airplane going from coast to coast, 85% of the time is a little bit off course, and it's always correcting. The problem with me is that I wouldn't correct, and pretty soon, instead of going to New York, I'm heading to Mexico. And that's what happens. It's a very slippery slope, and it can happen very easily and quickly for me. So I have to be diligent about it. I had a sponsee with a gift for analogy, and he said, I can't stay clean today on yesterday's shower. It's one of the greatest things I've heard in program. Because it doesn't matter how many years of abstinence I've got. If anything, that makes me cocky and makes me think, hey, you got this. You can relax. You can take it easy. It only matters what I do in the next 24 hours or the next 2 hours or the next 5 minutes or the next 1 minute. I have to stay clean based on what I'm doing today. And what I did in the past, you know, it may help me to get there. But it doesn't assure me any success, and it doesn't really mean anything if I'm not going to act that way in the same way in the future. So the whole part of the program to me is about getting something that takes care of what sets off the obsession. And what sets off the obsession? Well, for me, it was the dis-ease of various things in life. That if I was upset about something, food always soothed me as a kid. It was a constant friend. And it worked for short periods of time. The consequence of it, unfortunately, was horrific eventually. But for short periods of time, it'll soothe me. Although there's an expression, if you have a problem and you eat over it, you have two problems. And that's certainly been my experience, because then I eat over it and the problem is still there, and I now feel guilty, and I now feel fat, and I now feel like I've blown it and I'm disgusted with myself, and that puts me into a darker spiral. If I have a program, if I can be honest to people, if I can reach out, if I can talk about what's going on, then I can release and get a peace and serenity I did not expect. So back to that expression, I came for the vanity, stayed for the sanity. That's my experience. I mean, if you asked me why I was here on day one, I would look at you like, is this a trick question? I'm here to lose weight. Why the hell else would I be showing up at places like this? If you ask me today, I'll tell you because I don't want to eat compulsively. And they're very different. I can lose weight while eating compulsively. I can just force myself and white knuckle it and build up tension, but, you know, barrel my way through it, for at least for some period of time. But today I can get a release not just from the food, but in almost every area of my life. I mean, the 12 steps are a solution to the things that cause me a dis-ease in my life if I will practice them, if I get honest about them, if I look at them, really look at them, and figure out what's going on. And then if I get rid of the underlying emotion and the tension in a healthy way, in a way that keeps me spiritually fit, in a way that makes me feel like I'm not secretly alone doing all these things, then I get a release from the obsession, but it's short-term. It's based on my staying, as the Big Book says, in fit spiritual condition. And so if I stay in fit spiritual condition, I get a release from the obsession, and that's different from anything I ever felt in the past. I mean, that is a real release. I mean, it means that the obsession doesn't show up in the same way. Does it show up periodically? Of course. But, you know, I have tools to deal with it that I never had before. I have vivid memories of reaching for something that I probably shouldn't be eating, and as it's going into my mouth, saying, this is probably not a good idea. Now at least I have a couple of seconds between the time it gets in my hand and the time it gets in my mouth that I never had before. And as long as I stay in good spiritual condition, I get a release from it. I don't have to give in to the obsession the way that I used to. And I find something far greater. I find that I get better in my work. I found that the key to my spiritual success was a shifting from, remember how I described it came in, it was all about me. You know, how much can I get, how fast can I get it, how little can I give, and how quickly can I get out of here? Now, if I shift my focus outward, it's not about me. If I'm thinking about what I can do to be helpful to somebody else, I'm not in my own obsession. I'm not sitting around just thinking of me. And by doing that, and there's plenty of opportunities to do it. It comes up all the time in my work. It comes up in my personal and family relationships. It comes up particularly in program when I have sponsees, which to me is one of the most powerful tools in the program, is sponsoring somebody else. Because I can't tell you how many times I've been annoyed by something, have a sponsee call up with a similar problem, and I find myself giving him the advice that I need to hear about this is what my experience is. Advice is the wrong word. We're not supposed to give advice, but sharing my experience of what I've done in the past to get past things like that. And all of a sudden, I find myself in a better place. And I've gotten outside myself. My mind works very logically, but the program to me was not logical. It's almost paradoxical. It's in the sense that I have to admit I'm powerless over food in order to have power over food. That doesn't make any logical sense to me. But this, to me, has been an experiential program. It's been something that I had to experience. I can logically tell you that it works for me, but I can't tell you the logic of how it works. I can only tell you that it does. And it was not something, as I said, that I thought I could do. It was not something that I thought I could take care of on my own. So, you know, for me to open up and to, you know, let my life be guided so that I know that, for example, something happening to me that I really don't like, if I can see that in a bigger context, if I can see that in the context of that there's a plan to me, that my higher power has a bigger plan, and then I can get past the short-term disappointments with the understanding that there'll be something else for me at the end of the road. My concept of a higher power, it's like a flow of energy in the universe. It's a wave of sorts, a musical note, a musical wave, a wave of water. It's a flow of a stream. If I get into the flow and I flow with it, my life gets great. If I swim upstream and I fight it, not only do I wear myself out, I end up in the same place anyway, because the stream is more powerful than I am, and it's going to take me there. One of the wonderful things I heard in program was that God only gives you three answers. Yes. Yes, but not now. Or no, I have something better for you. And that's been my experience. I remember an analogy once of you look at a television set and you see a body on a table and someone sticking a knife in it. You think you're watching a murder. You pull back the camera and you see it's a surgeon trying to save somebody's life. Well, God has a view farther back than we do. So I have to trust that when I'm looking at something narrow and when I'm caught up just in what's for me, my life can get disappointing. But if I take a step back and I understand that things are going to happen, maybe the way I don't like it, then my life gets better. One of my favorite passages in the big book is on 4:17 about acceptance. Acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. And it's when I'm disturbed, it's because there's some person, place, thing, or situation not to my liking, and I can't have any serenity until I accept it as being exactly the way it's supposed to be at the moment. Very powerful for me. My sponsor, Michael, knew Dr. Paul, who wrote that section of the big book, and he said, Dr. Paul said to him, you know, Michael, acceptance doesn't mean approval. And I thought, that's, again, powerful. Because it's not what I want, or it's not that I necessarily like what's happening, but if it's a reality, if I fight against it, then the only one I'm frustrating is me. And in fact, if it's another person, they probably don't even know about it, and they don't even care how I feel about it. So I can only keep my side of the street clean. I can only do what I like. I heard a flippant expression from someone who said, never tell people your troubles. 85% of them don't care. The other 15% are glad you have them. So I need to concentrate on my side of the street. I need to do what I need to do to take care of myself. And as long as I do that, and as long as I keep going, and as long as I keep going to meetings, talking to sponsees, I write a daily inventory to go over whatever's on my mind and read it to my sponsor. As long as I do these few simple things, it doesn't take a long period of time, I get another clean day, and I get another day of serenity. Again, not perfect. There are days when I'm upset. There's days when things don't go the way I want them. Sometimes it's really small, but it's really annoying and messes with my serenity. But at least I've got, you know, a target, and at least I've got a plan, and at least I have tools that I can use to deal with it. So I think I will stop at this point. I don't know what the time is, but I will, and then I'd be happy to take some questions. Debbie.
Michael, Don, Jesus, he said Michael so many times he was here. Don, can you give an example of a situation where you were disappointed and then trusted God and saw the bigger picture downstream?
Yeah, the question is, was there a situation where I was disappointed and then later down the road saw the bigger picture? The one that comes to mind, I can't be very specific about because it's a business issue, but it was someone that I thought I could, that I wanted to make a deal with very badly, and I was unable to do it. And literally years later, I found out that if I had made it, it would have been horrific, and I wouldn't have gotten something else that was even greater. It took years, but sorry not to be more specific.
No,
but
that's perfect. Thank you.
Yes.
Hi, thank you so much for your share. Can you describe like a situation or a challenge that you've experienced in abstinence that you really like was very hard or challenging or painful that you used the program to get through?
Can I describe a situation that was very hard or challenging or painful that I used the program to get through? I'm so used to using it that it happens a fair amount. But I'm trying to think of something particularly dramatic. There was a situation in our family where someone had a very bad health problem, and the people around them were very upset. And it was very disturbing, and I just had to stick with the program that this was going to work itself through and work it out, and I could do what I could do to be supportive and to help. But beyond that, the results were not in my hands, and fortunately, after a year or so, it worked out quite nicely.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thanks for your share. Could you describe your daily conscious contact with your higher power, how you get there, and what your practice is like?
Sure. What's my daily conscious contact with the higher power? How do I get there and what it's like? I start the morning with a reading from For Today, which is a good way to get me in a place. I don't do a formal prayer or meditation, but I'm continually sort of checking in. Certainly calling my sponsor puts me in a good place, because when I write the inventory, it forces me to look at what's going on in my life, and if I need help, I need it. If I'm bothered about something on my own, I'll just sort of take a deep breath and let it go and say, I'm turning it over, you know, show me, I choose to call God, but show me, you know, what to do here, because I really don't know, and I'm trusting that it'll be okay. And for the most part, I can let go of it, not always, of course. And then I talk to people about it. I mean, if it's something that I can get advice on from people in or out of program, I'll do that. I'll certainly talk to my sponsor about it. And that's generally what I do. Yeah.
Hi, thank you so much. I was wondering what your abstinence and food plan was, and kind of more specifically how it started and how it changed throughout your recovery.
Okay. Question is, what's my abstinence and food plan, and how it started and how it's changed? My abstinence from the beginning was 3 meals a day and occasional snack. That was big for me, because I'm a night eater, and so I would start eating at dinner and not stop till I went to sleep. And that was probably the biggest issue. I never ate that much during the day, but I could if the opportunity was there for it. So 3 meals a day was a big change, and an occasional snack that I needed. My food plan from the beginning was always all foods in moderation, because I knew if I was really restricting, that was just going to be a trigger and send me off. What I did, but I had a difference with a weight-losing food plan and a maintenance food plan. So in the beginning, it was a weight-losing food plan, and I cut out all the things that you would normally want to cut out. I mean, the sugars, the desserts, the, you know, breads, pastas, things like that, kept to a minimum. I didn't cut them out completely, but kept to a minimum. And then when I got to a maintenance, you know, I mean, the sweets are not particularly my thing. I maybe have a few desserts a year, maybe 4 or 5, something like that. I go face down on salty stuff. That's much more of an issue for me. So I have to be very careful with that. You know, I went through the red light, green light, and yellow light foods. Red meaning that once I take one bite, it triggers the allergy and I'm gone. Green meaning it's, you know, it's a neutral food for me. And yellow meaning that it's something I have to be cautious of, or as some people put it, a red light food I'm not yet willing to admit is a red light food. So it's not specific foods that set me off, as I know some people are, but that's generally how it worked. Yes.
Thank you so much, Don. Can you talk about how your relationship with your higher power has evolved over the years, and what helped you to get closer to your higher power?
Sure. The question is, how's my relationship with my higher power evolved over the years, and how did I get closer? I grew up very spiritually, although not particularly religiously. My mom was extremely spiritual, and she was all the time growing up talking about, you know, God helps you in your life, and that God doesn't let you make a mistake. If you're trying to get something too hard, it's not right for you. And then I completely drifted away from it. And when I came back to program, it was like a happy, I'd forgotten that God was the center of the 12 steps. I think I knew it at one point, but I'd forgotten it. And to me, it was kind of a happy homecoming. It was like resonant to go back to it and deal with it. And so I think it's gotten better just because of practice. I mean, if I get used to talking to God on a relatively regular basis, then the dialogue is easier. It's sort of like, if you've got a friend you haven't seen in a few years, it can be awkward in the first few meetings together, and then you get more comfortable with each other. So that's kind of like what it was like for me. Yeah.
John, thanks very much for your share. Can you talk about, you mentioned you do a daily 10 step, and like I just happen to know that you have a very busy life. How do you work it all in with work, family, kids, work, you know, hobbies. program sponsor, sponsee, how do you do it all and have the willingness to do it?
The question is, you know, if you have a really busy life, how do you do it all? How do you work your program into it? I remember, and this will sound like a non sequitur, but it's tied in. I remember going to my doctor when I was heavy, and he was saying, you know, you should be exercising more. And I said, I really don't have time to do it. And he says, you know, that's BS. You have time to do the things that are important for you, don't you? And I thought, well, yeah. And so I make it a priority. I make it an important part of my day. And as long as, look, we're not talking about huge amounts of time, but it's inevitably, even though I think it's an intrusion, it helps me. I mean, because it can take me out of whatever other obsession I might be in or other stress I might be in. So I just make it a priority. I make sure that I do it and don't let it get away from me. Because remember the airplane getting a little off course. If I'm not diligent about it, it will. And so I just have to make time. Yes.
Thank you. Can you talk about your experience with the Big Book? Did you get guided into reading it, or do you pick it up, and how has it changed over the years?
Okay. Question is, what's my experience with the Big Book? Well, my sponsor uses Dr. Paul's guide, which is not AA approved. It's an unofficial guide to the 12 steps, but it's a very formal way to go through it. So that was my experience. And then I've used the same thing when I do it with sponsees. So going back through it with sponsees takes me through it again. I don't like read it regularly just, you know, to pick it up. But I get a lot from it every time I do it. And I also like to listen to AA recordings or OA recordings because I find those helpful as well, just for the insights. I always hear and learn something a little different. Yes?
What character defect have you worked on the most in program?
What character defect have I worked on the most in program? Probably the selfishness, probably just the self-centeredness, because that is my default. And I have to really be diligent to make sure I don't go back there, because I know that the key to my staying and to having the psychic change, as the Big Book calls it, was turning outward, because that was a real change from everything being about me, which, in my experience, was not a happy existence, because I'm bound to be disappointed by something if it's something that I want and I don't get. But if I'm outward thinking, and if I'm thinking what I can do to be helpful to others, I don't get into that mind space. Yes?
Can you talk about working with sponsees, like when you first start working with them and what you do with them?
Yeah. What do I do when I first start working with sponsees? I ask somebody, before I commit to sponsoring them, I ask them to start calling me regularly. Because I want to see if they're going to just make the effort to call on a daily basis, because if they're not willing to do that, they're probably not willing to do much more. So that's the first thing that I do. And then I want them to get about 30 days of abstinence before we work the steps, again, to see that they're serious about it. I have them create an abstinence. I have them create a food plan. I have them report the food in. If they're not willing to do these things, then, you know, I'm sure there's other folks that would sponsor them, but just that's my experience, so I pass on my experience. Yes?
What advice did you give yourself to your past self when you first came into program?
What advice would I give to my past self when I came into program? Well, when I came in, I was actually ready. I would have rather given my past self that advice 10 years earlier when I heard about it and said, get your ass in there. So whether it would have worked or not, probably not. Everything in life happens when it's supposed to, and I wasn't ready. Yes?
Thank you so much for your share. Do you still have a food plan every day, and do you still share it with your sponsor?
I report the food that I eat, I do have a food plan, but it's not the specific foods as we talked about. It's all foods in moderation, and being cautious around the yellow light foods. And yes, I report what I eat, so I'm accountable for it.
At the end of the day.
At the end of the day. He's been trying to get me to report it in advance for 20 plus years. But he hasn't succeeded. Probably something I should work on too. Anything else? Yeah.
Can you talk more about your 10th step?
The 10th step. Yeah. I do it with the vowels A E I O U, so it's very organized. A is abstinence. E is exercise, meaning what did I eat? E is exercise. I is what I do for myself. O, what I do for others. U is an uncovering, which breaks into three parts. He calls it a reefer. It's R-F-R, which is a resentment of something in the world, a fear that I have, or a resentment of something about myself. Then there's a Y, which is a Yahoo for something that happened I'm happy about. And then there's three G's for three things I'm grateful for. So I write that out and either read it to him or leave it on his voicemail if I don't get him. Anything else? Thank you for letting me share.
Okay. It is now time for...